Okay, so thank you all for coming, and a special thank you to the organizers, especially the local organizers. In fact, I don't see one of the organizers who's not local, so we can give him a round of applause when Dima walks in. Right, so today I'm going to tell you how, really how zebrafish come to explore and balance in the water column. I've noticed that the talks that seem to engage us most as a community are somewhat more focused on behavior. So I'm not going to talk about the neural underpinnings of any of the work that I'm doing, but I'm happy to talk about it this afternoon if you'd like. The talk always has to start by reminding you that gravity works. So it is something that we absolutely take for granted. We do not think about it at all subjectively or objectively, but of course, if we were to stop sensing gravity's constant downward pull on our bodies, and if we were to stop stiffening our neck and maintaining our trunk orientation, we would flop like rag dolls. I think that this is something that all animals for many, 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 many hundreds of millions of years have been attuned to, and so too have their nervous systems. The most fascinating thing to me is that animals are neither born with nor throughout development maintain a constant relationship with gravity because, of course, bodies change. This is something that you're all familiar with. Let's take a look at Ruby. She's taking some of her first steps. This was last week's speaker here, Kathy Nagel. Okay, but to her credit, just a month later, here she is. She's about to take her first steps, some of her first steps. Watch how well she can maintain orientation in the pitch, nose up, nose down axis. Spoiler alert, she's not going to make it. She shifts to an entirely different mode of locomotion, which is preferred, and says, to hell with this. Now, again, a short time later, here she is at the playground. Not only can she, hey, Dima, welcome. Not only can she walk nicely across this uneven balance beam, but watch how she uses her arms to give herself additional stability. So she's engaged in a coordinated set of behaviors that allow her to navigate despite this force being ever present that maybe that's another dad saying, wow, that's not me. And here's the central problem for Ruby, and really for all of us, and for many, many animals. She's top-heavy. So basically, she's a bobblehead doll. So like about a third of her weight is up here in this unstable, floppy head thing. And of course, she can't wait 10, 15 years till she reaches her mature proportions and then say, okay, now is about time to move. Whatever it is that her brain does to enable her to locomote in the face of gravity is something that has to be continually changing as her body changes. Forgive me, of course, because I study larval zebrafish, and I don't study humans. They're much, much more complicated. Underwater, a lot of the physical demands become simpler to parameterize. But throughout the talk, I may refer to our subjective experience of moving through the world by means of analogy. So this is a zebrafish. You've heard from Claire, you've heard from Jimmy about the fish. I'll point out that this thing is so small you could fit two of them under your thumbnail and you wouldn't notice. If you don't believe me, go to the fish module and see if you can actually see them. You need a microscope. There are certain things that being small means for the fish. We'll talk about those, and also certain things that being small make tractable in terms of experiments. So, and anatomically, they're very similar to us. They have large eyes. They use vision to navigate in the light. They have vestibular end organs here in the ear. They have fins. They have a gas-filled organ called the swim bladder. We'll talk a little bit about that as well. And I'd like to tell you three things if we have time. I'd like to tell you some work that's published on why zebrafish move when they do. I'd like to tell you a little bit of work that's preprint now, how zebrafish explore depth. And lastly, if we have time, I'd like to talk about something I have not talked about before, which is how zebrafish come to climb. And that's a story about coordinated movements. So let's start with why zebrafish move when they do. This is the work of a very talented postdoc, David Ehrlich, shown here enjoying cheesecake. And David asked, essentially about bout timing, or why zebrafish move when they do. I think one of the things that all of you, having looked at animals, can appreciate is that it is relatively straightforward for us as scientists to understand how is it that we would parameterize an animal's movement. We measure kinematics, we can measure joint angles, we can measure position relative to a sensory cue that we put out, or relative to gravity. But one of the things that's extremely challenging to know if you're just watching an animal is when is it going to move next? Just watch, you know, this is this internal variable that's somewhere in the brain that gives the probability of moving in the next instant of observed time. That's really tricky to get at. And what David sort of started out by saying is, well, let's see if just by watching the fish move many, 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 many hundreds of thousands of times, we can gain some insight into why they move when they move. So the first thing that David did was he asked, what are the physical forces that act on a zebrafish as it's swimming? And the two main ones are schematized here, but let me define a couple things for you first. So this is the long axis of the zebrafish's body. Let's see if we can try this. Long axis of the zebrafish's body relative to the horizon gives you an angle theta. That's the pitch of the fish. We'll talk about posture exclusively in this pitch axis for the rest of the talk. In the pitch axis, there are two forces that really matter. The first is the buoyant force, which acts at the center of volume. It's basically the water pushing back up on the fish's body and would cause the fish to rise. And then, just like it does here, gravity works underwater, so it pulls the fish down, and it acts at the center of mass. Center of mass and volume are schematized by circles. They're offset in the schematic because they're offset in real life. This was something that David figured out after taking photomicrographs of fish and estimating the centers of mass and volume. And this is what he found. At all ages, there was this offset. So what does that mean? Well, that means that the fish is essentially top-heavy in the same way that, he's top-heavy. And that means that a fish at rest, particularly one whose body is oriented with the horizon, is subject to a constant nose-down torque. The fish will be doing this, which would mean that this is a stable fish relative to gravity. Head down, the buoyant force and gravity are in opposition, and there's no acceleration anymore. But of course, we don't see fish like this. In fact, quite the opposite. We see them at 90 degrees to this. So we're going to argue for the rest of the talk that that's actually something the nervous system does. I don't know, where's Dima? This is another Dima experiment, because he yelled at us until we did this. So what David did to test whether the nervous system was really involved is he put a fish at the top of an enclosure that had water very, very carefully. This fish is anesthetized, so we can watch what happens when the nervous system is out of the equation. You'll see the fish zoomed in here as I play the video, and this is where I make that sound as it drops, but you can see it rotate. So again, for the rest of the talk, I'm going to argue that the fish position, the body orientation relative to the horizon, that pitch angle is something that the nervous system actively maintains, and it's seeking an active equilibrium with these forces to seek to destabilize it. So I mean, the nervous system needs to be involved, and you will see, I'll describe the movements that the fish engages in, and why they stabilize the fish, and how they come to do that.
Maybe you can address that later, but why would the thing evolve to have this top-heavy, rather than a, you know, neutral kind of...
Yeah, so there are the... We do know that many animals are top-heavy. We don't know why. At least the simplest thing that I can come up with right off the top of my head, one of the major contributors at this stage to the difference in the density is the calcification of the bones. The bones are not calcified when the fish develops, right? That's something that has to happen across time, and that happens from the nose back to the tail. So you could say, why does it happen from the nose back to the tail? I don't know what the signals are that initiate calcification and travel, but certainly at these early stages, it's always going to be top heavy because the top is always going to be calcified before the end of the fish.
So once the fish is adult, mm-hmm. is it corrected or is it still top?
No. As far as we can tell, it is not. There are other biophysical considerations, right, in terms of optimizing maneuverability, that such a distribution of mass and volume would be beneficial. But again, we're waving our hands at this point. It's sort of, oh, it's good for this, therefore it must have evolved for that. I'm going to try my best not to engage in that sort here. Okay, so, yeah, sure.
It looked like it was moving very slowly, so is it a very small difference in these two portions? Did you mention that? How much of a difference?
The distance between the two is very small.
So of course they're very, very close together.
But there's just not that much space for them, right? They're really small, so they're really close together, that's right.
And this is these are saltwater fish?
These are freshwater fish.
Okay.
Is
it different saltwater? I guess they only live in freshwater.
Right? Well, let's... So the... I'm just going to, by fiat, say that though we could talk about this ad nauseum, because there are the majority of identified vertebrates are fish, and they exist in pretty much every habitat, and of course the physics change a little bit depending on their habitat. By fiat, so that we can get through this, I'd like to focus just on the zebrafish, and we can talk about what's different about saltwater fish later, if that's okay. So the apparatus that David designed is very simple and should be familiar to most of you because you've kind of pushed on something like this in your own labs. We have infrared illumination illuminating a small cuvette. The cuvette's 50 millimeters by 50 millimeters by 20 millimeters. So you're seeing the 50 by 20 dimension. There's a machine vision camera and a lens. There's white light illumination above, so we can run these experiments over long periods of circadian time. And I think, yeah. So these are the fish swimming in the cuvette. This is the IR light behind. And that's the field of view. And we take many thousands of videos of fish swimming through this field of view. And they look like this. And this one sort of illustrates the key things that I'm going to talk about for this part of the talk. There are a couple things that you need to know. First, Jimmy introduced Reynolds' number, the ratio of inertial forces and viscous forces. At the size, the small size of these fish, their relationship to water is comparable to us swimming through jello. So we could swim in a large swimming pool full of jello, but we wouldn't glide very far. We would make our muscular contractions and we would move in these saltatory or jumpy bouts. And that's what you're going to see first. The fish is going to move in jumpy bouts. And then in between the bouts, it's basically paused. And during that pause period, because there's no glide, we can actually see this rotation happen. So let's take a look. It'll be strongest as the fish approaches the horizon. So this is 4 days old. Eyes, swim bladder, swimming. You can watch this sort of rotation, particularly now, and also after each bout, you can see that rotation is not accumulating. The bout seems to cancel whatever the effect of that acceleration was.
Is there Reynolds
yes.
number?
Is there a...
How much is the Reynolds number?
Depends on the exact size, but between 10 and 100. So it's not the regime of interesting things that humans build, and it's not the fascinating regime of bacteria that need sort of propeller-like flagella and things. Please.
Would you point out where is it? Are the swimming appendages? It's hard to see.
Yeah, so you'll get a much better view of that shortly in the talk. But the predominant thrust is produced by the tail here, and the contractions are similar to, you know, they're swimming the way Jimmy showed you, but it's in and out of the plane of, so yeah, you won't see much by way of contraction here. But you will have a little bit better view soon when we zoom in on the fish. Okay? So, just to, again, make clear the parameterizations, because that's going to be key. If we were to plot the speed of the fish as a function of time, we could very easily pick out those fast bouts, and we could set thresholds on speed, what we call a bout, and we can set thresholds on what we're calling the pause period. And that makes it straightforward to examine the orientation of the fish, so negative would be nose down in the pitch axis, right? And you can see there's a slight downward rotation during the pauses that is largely counteracted during the bouts. So for the first study, and I think actually everything I'm going to talk about, we studied the fish across a number of developmental ages. So here would be 0 days where sperm fertilizes egg. Here's 4 days post-fertilization. This is basically when they start to swim. The goal of the fish, as Claire told you, is to feed itself and get the hell out of Dodge in the face of anything, because basically anything is dangerous and eats this fish. It gets older till 21 days, and I'm showing you two views of the 21-day-old fish. At this stage, it's about a third of the way to sexual maturity, so this would be a 4-year-old, if you'll grant me, in human years. Again, this is a millimeter, so they're larger, but they're still pretty small. I have this to point out something about the morphology of the fish, and that's what I'll call the weather vane effect. So you notice that at the end of each of those bouts, at the end of each of those translations, the fish was no longer rotating nose down. And the easiest way to explain that is by reference to something that you all know well, which is a weather vane. So the weather vane, in response to wind, will always orient into the wind. What's that have to do with fish? Well, in the face of drag forces, either in flowing water, like Jimmy told you about yesterday, or if the fish translates that away, the water will push back on it, those are acting at the center of pressure. They can be modeled as acting at the center of pressure, which is displaced the same as it would be in a wind vane relative to the center of mass. So you have a force which orients the fish relative to the direction of the flow. So a bout, we reasoned, would actually stabilize this nose down torque that would otherwise have the fish pointing nose down.
So that means any bout would move the fish up, whatever the bout?
Not necessarily up. Right? It would depend. Any bout will stabilize, right?
So stabilize means going to the horizontal?
It means opposing any accumulated velocities, right? Most of those are going to be down, but imagine that you had a convective current or something else that was pushing the fish up and it translated, it would oppose that. Does that make sense? I've only told you about this downward force, so yes, in the universe of the talk, you are correct. But in general, there are other things that can affect fish.
Because when they start these movements, essentially they are at rest with respect to the water, right?
If the water is still.
Even if the water is not still, they are going to be. After 1 second, you essentially at rest with the water around you.
Yeah.
So in that case, I don't see why you should consider these flaps around the fish.
Well, let's. So you're no longer at rest when you initiate the movement, right? You're comfortable with that idea. If you start moving, you're not at rest with respect to the water. So let's look at what happens, right?
So what David did was he took the tens of thousands of bouts that we had observed,
and he aligned them at peak speed. And what he did was he divided all of these bouts into quintiles based on the velocity before the bout, right? So you're going to see a bunch of different velocities here. You'll see the bout happen, and then we'll measure velocity afterwards, right? So that's velocity. Okay, so let's take a look at the quintiles. So what's the fish doing? Most of these are below zero, so the fish is usually rotating nose down, as described before. Sometimes it is not. Then there's the bout, which we'll talk in detail about a little bit later, what's exactly happening here. But after the bout, the velocity is much reduced, regardless of whether the fish was rotating up or down. So this is at 21 days post-fertilization. We can...
But then they should go back to their resting state, right?
I'm sorry.
If you are recording long enough, they should go back to the resting state before the bout, right?
If we continued out here, eventually the data would fall along this distribution.
Right.
Yes?
And based on how much they fill their swim bladder, they're all different than that, right? Mm. They might have like a different baseline for the...
So the swim bladder is not going to affect this rotational velocity. The swim bladder will change their density relative to the density of the water. And Claire is right. There's a wide variation in that. That would tell you whether the fish would drop, whether it would sink, but not whether it would rotate, right? So it's best saved for afterwards, where I can show you some data about that. But yes, just to make 100% clear, this is not a translation that I'm showing you here. This is a rotation. So if we summarize this by taking the average value in this period and this period, then we can plot the data like so. And you can see if we connect them, they're largely returning to zero.
David, it's a question I always wonder, like, in the spinnaker, you don't find more neurons that are continuously active at rest. So it looks like, at least in the spinal cord, there is no posterior motor neuron that are tonically active. But do you think that the resting position of your fish depends, you know, on their morphology, or it also depends on them actively trying to maintain balance?
Let's talk about that when we've gotten to the, you know, if you give 20 minutes, it'll be an easier time for everybody else to follow that conversation. So please do ask me again. At 21 days, the fish is doing really well, and not so much when it's first starting to swim, but the trend is there. The fish is capable of correcting for this rotational accumulation, this rotational velocity, when it bouts. So that seemed to suggest that there was something about the bouts, probably due to this weather vane effect, that would, I love this, half of the physicists are doing this right now in the room. The bout should be stabilizing. So we wanted to test that. We wanted to change the physics of the fish in some way relative to its environment and see if indeed they changed the bout frequency, because if they're using that to stabilize and we made them less stable, then we should see more of that. So how do we do that? Well,
can you just clarify something?
Please, I can try.
So at that developmental stage, is about the only way for them to stabilize, to correct the angle or the
as
pitch?
So the, again, I apologize. I'll show you more about how, you know, what we know about how they rotate in the second part of the talk. So if you don't mind, same as Claire, just hold it and I will do my best to get back to it.
Just want to make sure I understood the last part.
Yeah.
So essentially most of the time, as you were alluding to at the beginning, they mm-hmm. first have to go head down mm-hmm. and then they have a bout and then they stabilize. They essentially never swim and they're totally horizontal, and some, that's right, and they sometimes are very, yeah, like 1 out of 5 times are head up when they swim and then they become horizontal. Is that what you showed?
So what I showed you was the velocity. right? So they could be pitched way head up and rotating nose down, or way down and rotating nose up. So what you just described was a pitch situation. You said they're facing nose up and swimming. They could be facing nose up or nose down. Fish prefer a slightly nose up posture, but around that preferred nose up posture, it's roughly Gaussian. So their pitch could be nose up or nose down. The velocity could be at any point either up or down, and it is often downward. Does that make sense? Okay.
So the idea is that the corrective effect of pulse is purely hydromechanical. So it's purely hydrodynamics. It's from the hydrodynamic that is corrected. So because you could also imagine that the fish does something a little subtle, and depending on the pitch, makes a bout that's going to go, you know, pitch down or pitch up. So.
Yeah. So hold that thought, because we will talk about that in the second part of the talk.
Okay.
I suppose I should come clean. When we first saw that data, right, being neuroscientists, we were so excited. Like, wow, every time it goes, you know, it's down, it goes up, and every time it's rotating up, it goes down. This is this amazingly exquisite, beautiful, reflexive behavior that the nervous system could be doing. And then we started talking to some fish biomechanists, and, you know, especially the ones that fly airplanes, they just said, you know, Davids, you guys are idiots. You don't know what you're talking about. Just read these books on simple hydrodynamic principles, and it will become clear to you, you don't need a nervous system, as Jimmy illustrated. You don't need even to be alive for some of these stabilizing features. But if you have a fish that is alive, you can take advantage of one of these behaviors that it does very early, which is to inflate the swim bladder. So the swim bladder is full of air, and the only source of air that the fish can use at this age is up top. So what the fish has to do, it starts low, it actually adheres to things as it climbs, and then will break the surface of the water, gulp air, which enters the swim bladder. That allows it to swim much, much more efficiently because it is much better matched to the density of water instead of being this heavy thing. So what David did was he said, all right, if I raise fish in air, with an air-water interface, then they can fill their swim bladders with air. So that's this guy. You can see the swim bladder's full of air. But if you raise them in salad dressing, or with a layer of mineral oil on top of the water, then when the fish swim up, they end up gulping, but not air, but oil. So now we have a fish with an oil-filled swim bladder, which, of course, you can see is kind of shinier, and is much heavier, and here's what the swimming looks like. It's doing its best. They don't survive for very long like this. But if we look at the time between bouts, right? The bout frequency essentially, or the inner bout interval, in air and in oil, you can see that there are many, many, many short intervals in the oil data that there are not in the air data. So another way of saying that is that the fish are making many more of these stabilizing bouts. We thought, oh, that's pretty cool. Maybe you know, the hydrodynamicists were right, and these bouts are really central to helping fish maintain stability in the face of gravity. So then we ran into this this issue, which is that what we really wanted to know is this latent variable. We would like to know the instantaneous probability of making a bout as a function of the fish's pitch and velocity, right? You know, how is the fish oriented in the water, and how is it moving in the water, and does it use those variables to determine when it's going to move? That was the goal of David's study. But fortunately, you know, we're not going to get to this. That's kind of, you would have to look at everything that the brain is doing and make a whole bunch of inferences based on neural activity as to what this probability was, and then there's all kinds of other things. So what we did have was a ton of these bouts. And that meant that we could compute the probability of seeing a particular theta and theta dot, or fish orientation and rotation, when the bout had happened. And that meant that we could use Bayes' rule. So we could normalize that by the overall probability of seeing this combination of theta and theta dot. And we could multiply that by a term that encompassed the Bayesian probability of making the bout. And we could get this latent or hidden variable or thing that we would have to infer here. So that was very exciting because it meant that we might actually be able to make an inference about when an animal is going to move. So what does that look like? Well, I apologize for this because it's a heat map. And I like to keep the diagrams as simple as possible, but it's really the best way to show you if we plot for any given theta and theta dot, or position, pitch and angular velocity, what is the relative bout likelihood, which could go from zero to very, very high numbers. Now, if there's structure in this, if it's sort of a mish of blue and yellow all over the place, then the likelihood of making a bout is independent of these variables. If there is structure in this diagram, though, we can infer that the fish is using information about pitch and velocity to determine when it's going to make one of these bouts. And of course, I'm telling you about this, so it worked. This is zero and this is zero. So when the fish is not far from the horizon or not, and or not moving very fast, it has a much lower likelihood of making a bout relative to the edges here when it's rotating much faster or it's pitched way away. And I guess if you take one thing away from the first part of the talk, or maybe even the whole talk, it's this. This structure does not emerge at the earliest stages. It's much more distributed relative to 21 days. So what we can conclude from this is that this is something that the fish are actually learning. The fish is coming to move preferentially when it's unstable, which is a very fancy way of saying the fish is learning to balance. So once we have this relationship, oh, please.
Just getting back to the question of learning and adjusting. So the morphology itself will also alter the stability, because where the center buoyancy relative to the gravity is the center.
Yeah.
Measurements of that.
Yes, and it gets worse. They're even more top heavy.
That's right. So therefore, that couldn't be a contributing factor to this, meaning that they are relatively stable when they're young.
And then
as they become more unstable, they have to use this strategy.
The intuition is right. If you anesthetize a 4-day fish, it ends up nose down. If you anesthetize a 21-day-old fish, it ends up nose down. And the speeds with which they hit with which they rotate are not that different. It may be at the size of the fish or for the nervous system of the fish. It matters a tremendous deal. We don't know that yet. Please finish.
But you're saying they're both unstable.
They're both unstable.
But the time scale for instability, for this instability, you can't tell them apart. That's what you're saying.
I think that's right. But let's discuss it more if there's something that doesn't ring true. Please, Claire.
Did you try the Arlene to do the same diagram for the Arlene?
There's a bunch of data that I don't have time to tell you about, following up on the oil experiment, which makes them heavier, and also this sort of goes to the earlier question about salt water and water. If we let them swim in glycerol, they're actually they rotate nose up. The everything changes. So we can do glycerol and oil experiments to play along this axis, and I won't get to tell you about that now, but yes, we have done those experiments. Was there something specific that you were looking for?
I was wondering if you change the pattern there, when they are in orange, like how do they... Because on the video, it's very different, right?
That's right. So they adopt... Yeah, the... I can probably show you that data later this afternoon. We can talk about it. Matthew, I think you had a question.
Yeah, so the force balance or the morphology of the animal may also explain like why they are not capable of like having that good control after 4 days. So when you say it's learning, like what's behind
it? Yeah. So this is fun because we very studiously did not use the word learning in the manuscript. You won't find it in there. But I'm happy to talk about it because I like to share, I think, the bigger context. Let me think if we have, I think I have the data that essentially shows you that at 4 and 7 days, they're kinematically just as capable of doing the things as they are later. So that's the second part of the talk. So let's just hold off on that. And if you don't think it's substantially demonstrated, the truth is we haven't shown that the nervous system changes in any way. You could imagine the thought experiment. If you took a 4-day-old brain and you put it into a 21-day-old body, and just said, let's see what happens. You know, does this emerge? And we have lots of reasons to think that wouldn't work, because there are changes in the nervous system that we would call learning, but again, it's a longer discussion.
When you put fish in tracking, they don't all do the same thing, and even the adults, when they go even or at the surface, like with the head up, it's not clear to me that they all do go like head down when you euthanize them, you know? Like a dead fish, for me, it's like,
yeah,
a lot
so
of them to go,
so there are a number of studies on there. Yeah, that's the comment. Like, why do dead fish go belly up? There are a number of studies actually on what is changing about the composition of the fish, and where that change. Why do dead fish float up? And this is not it, right? There are many things that happen when an animal dies that change the density of the tissue, and will contribute to that role. So I can send you the relevant citation that studies the death of like 4 different species. Do you know this paper, Jimmy? It's pretty awesome. Well, you know, dead fish, right?
I was just wondering if is there some variation with like the same age across individuals of the distance between the center of gravity and the center of buoyancy?
So yes, I forgot to mention, I apologize. When we're running these experiments, we run a group of fish together. So there are 8 fish, 9 fish in that little cuvette. We don't run them individually, so we don't have data on how the individual's morphology relates to the swimming pattern. But that would be the data set that we would need to address that. Sorry, I think Michael had a question first.
Do you have any data that speaks directly to the fact that the younger fish are less stable?
Are less stable. No,
they have a harder time stabilizing themselves or spend more time exploring like higher rotational velocity.
So by and large, the velocities that they achieve, the pitches that they adopt are very similar. I'll show you one area in which it's not in a second. But I would not say on the face of it that a fish at a given age is more or less stable.
You've never done like perturbation experiments where you like actually, right? Because this is all under self-organized behavior.
That's right. We don't have gravity's a bitch to selectively perturb.
Yes and no. But it's possible that like
yes and
right,
no.
The older fish are just spending more time exploring sort of the edges, right? Of you know their what you know their
Yeah, so we don't see, I mean, I can show you this later, right? There's a big table in the paper that looks at everything that we could think of to look at to ask that question exactly. Is there something fundamentally different about the kinematics of the older fish than the younger fish? Sorry, I saw you had a question first, and then please.
So there seems to be a preference for bulking when they're headed downward.
They're nice. Yes, we do have a term in the model that we needed, which is a slight asymmetry. That is correct.
Good. Do you have any conjecture on why?
Yes, we. Let me think. As I recall, it has to do with the. Not 100% sure. I'm pretty sure that the best reason that we could come up with is the difference in the shape of the dorsal part of the fish and the ventral part of the fish. The ventral part of the fish has a particular curve to it versus the dorsal. The data later may speak to the difference between up and down when we talk about how they climb, because there are interesting up-down differences there. But I don't know, I would have to look back at the manuscript, so let's say I'm 60% confident that if I thought about it, I would come up with the dorsal-ventral again. You and Lenny.
Yeah, David. So it's just a clarifying question here. So I'm curious about the transitions between 14 and 21st days plus the F.
Fertilization.
Yeah, thank you. The first question is, are these plots normalized in any way to the probability of being in that particular pitch position?
They absolutely are.
So is it the yellow on the 14-day related to the fact that they're more on that sort of orientation and that triggers the instability triggered bout? Or is it and that transitions into a blue on the 21st because it just doesn't happen so much?
Mm-hmm.
Or there is something going on that determines what is stability or instability?
That's right. So your observation is correct. This has a numerator and a denominator. As I recall, this also speaks a little bit to Michael's question, the denominator, which is just the probability of seeing of ever being at a particular theta and theta dot combination, are largely comparable across the ages. So you really are seeing a legitimate difference emerge from the numerator.
What's your interpretation on that?
That the fish explore the full range of positions and velocities over the 20 odd hours that we're looking at them. There's nothing special about any position or velocity.
Sorry, I understood that the yellow relates to the fact that you're increasing the probability of actually generating a bout.
That's right.
So in the 21st, there is a corner there that actually decreases that probability that existed in previous weeks as a trigger for bout generation.
Yellow is a higher probability, blue is a lower probability.
Exactly.
You're talking about this corner.
Yeah, exactly.
I see.
That's
right.
My
right.
Sorry.
I think that... I cannot speak to every part of this diagram,
okay. But
I think we may be talking about the noise now in our measurement. That's the other thing, of course, that's not reflected, is how uncertain we are about the values in each of these bins. And I think if we were able to show you that, maybe as like a skyscraper plot or something, you would appreciate that there's not too much to be read into that.
Okay.
Actually, besides noise.
One second, please.
You said you did experiments in groups, right? I was wondering whether you have seen any difference of doing it like single fish or group fish, because there's some evidence that from 14 dpf to 21, there's some social interactions already happening. So I was wondering how much of the bouts that you are seeing are due also to the fact that they have other fish around.
So we did a number of controls. The resolving power, of course, drops when you have fewer fish. But to the best of our ability to tell, a single fish would look equivalent to these if we were able to get enough data. So that's not to say that there aren't fascinating social interactions happening in these guys, but they don't seem to be affecting these parameters. Please.
It's just difficult to compare because binning is different.
Yes.
And actually, the ones on the left, they have fewer bins. So if you normalize them to one, are they normalized to one?
They are normalized to have the same number of bouts per bin.
But how can I compare them? I mean, they look like...
What do you mean, how can you compare? You have your glasses off, so you can low-pass filter this, and you're just fine.
I have a perfect far vision. So
come close.
So bins are different, normalization is therefore different. Like, what should I infer from this?
I guess... I'm not really sure how to answer the question. Sitting here, what should I infer from this? If you can't make an inference from what I've shown you, I can't really help you. If you are saying I'm having trouble comparing the values in this corner to this corner to this corner because the bins are different size.
Yes.
I think that is a totally fair point. And if we had infinite data, they wouldn't be, but we don't. So we have to make a compromise, which is to ensure that we represent the data in the fairest way possible, which we did by ensuring that the same number of bouts were in evenly spaced bins. So that if you were to low-pass filter this, which is basically what we do when we write down a model to estimate these variables and play with it, then if I showed you that smooth gradient, you would say, oh, I can see the differences. But yeah, you're not meant, this is not a rich enough data set in the 6 months that we collected data to be able to compare point by point. Anybody else? Please, Matthew.
I would suggest that you move on because yep. There is like lots of questions that you may be able to address reaching the next part of the
Right, so we sought to model this, and you know what, I'm just going to assert that we can model it, just taking into account all the interesting things that we observed. This one's, we can model it, and it works, and you can read about it. So that was correct destabilization, and as they develop, larvae come to bout preferentially when they're unstable. So that was our data's and my best attempt to answer the question, why is it that zebrafish move when they do? They do so because moving helps to correct the accumulated forces that would otherwise put them nose down. So how do zebrafish explore depth? So first let me show you that zebrafish do actually explore depth. We can see a zebrafish going nose down here. This one is, this next bout, the fish starts horizontal, you can see. It rotates its body and then rotates back towards its preferred position along the horizontal. So when it's doing that, there are a couple ways that it can do it, but the predominant way that we discussed before is that it can produce thrust, in this case, in a particular direction. So which direction does it do it in? Well, if we look at the orientation of the fish before it makes that bout, and we look at the trajectory that the fish adopts, right, then if we plot data and it falls along the unity line, we have a fish that's going where its nose is pointed, which is familiar to all of you because that's, you know, you see fish swim and they go where their noses are pointed. But this sets up a problem for the fish. If the fish wants to explore in depth, that is, it wants to go up or it wants to go down, and it needs to explore where its nose is pointed, then it needs to rotate its body to face down or up. And that's a problem, because I've just spent a whole bunch of time telling you that it would like to be balanced relative to the horizon, like to adopt an orientation of its body that's slightly nose up. So lest you think that this is a problem that only fish face, again, if you'll forgive me for referring to us, every single one of you is going to go from your balanced state, which you're sitting in right now, you have to destabilize yourself relative to gravity to walk out of this room in order to get coffee. This is finding an equilibrium between exploratory orientations of one's body, of an animal's body, and maintaining a stable orientation relative to gravity is something that is fundamental and common to all animals that locomote. So to cut to the chase, what David found is that the zebrafish solve this problem by sequencing the rotations that they make in order to explore. Well, they'll rotate the long axis of their body first to explore, and then they perform a balancing rotation at the end of their bout. So these are some close-ups of the fish. You should be able to see a lot of the features that you guys were asking about before. I'm going to show you these. These are at half speed, and each one is to illustrate an either exploratory rotation or a balancing rotation. So the exploratory rotation will happen first, right when the fish is is translating, you'll be able to see it rotate and translate. So the fish is going to start off in this orientation, rotate and translate like so. I'll play it twice. Again, it's at half speed, so you can appreciate just how fast this is. And now I think you can see a little bit of the tail moving back and forth.
Do you get a sense of whether the tail can generate lift? Like a shark tail is heterocercal, it's kind of asymmetrical. So if it could, then the moment arm is quite great. That force generation in the center of gravity, let's say, and then it could tilt the fish up.
So we do think that the tail is doing a lot of the heavy lifting, and I'll show you the other possibility shortly, I think.
And also, do you get a sense of what the pectoral fins are doing?
That's the third part of the talk. So righting, or returning to that horizontal set point, here's, again, an exaggerated. The fish is going to finish coming out of this roll and pitch rotation, and then you'll actually see it return to its preferred nose-up set point. I'll play that again. So we can measure the gain or the strength of that righting reflex. We can parameterize that pretty simply by asking how close does it return to its preferred posture, schematized here by a line. A gain of 1 would allow the fish to return to a perfectly level horizontal position, and a gain of 0, the fish wouldn't have rotated at all. And I do this to show you that the righting gain is kind of crappy. Even if we look across development, we're really only reaching for fish a righting gain of about 0.15, 0.2. Compare this to most of your balancing reflexes, which, when you combine visual and vestibular information, allow you to stay perfectly balanced. You're not sitting in your chair compensating for 20% of the force of gravity, right? You're doing a much better job than that. So why is it that the zebrafish might have a low righting gain? Well, if we look at the exploration that it's doing, it's actually useful. When the fish wants to go up, instead of rotating up, back, up, back, up, back like a sawtooth, it will only rotate partially there. So the lower gain of the righting reflex during these exploratory behaviors allows the fish to more efficiently string together these thrusts that take it to a new place in depth.
Did you mention the movie again?
Yes. Well, show of hands, who really, really, really wants to see the movie again? Sorry, guys. I will show it to you ad nauseum afterwards. But to recap, the fish make bouts when unstable. We talked about that. And each bout partially returns the fish to its preferred posture. Okay. What happens at night? So this is a, everything I've been telling you about, this gets really problematic at night. And the reason it gets really problematic at night is because perhaps the most robust finding in animal behavior, certainly in the realm of circadian behavior, is that as a function of circadian time, in this case it's entrained to light dark, but it doesn't have to be, the movements that animals make vary. Right? We move less at night than we do during the day. Many animals do that. Nocturnal animals are reversed, but there's definitely a difference between light and dark. So the bout rate for the fish, as we found and many others have found, changes high in the light, low in the dark, high in the light, low in the dark, high in the light. And just to emphasize, that's true whether we have a normal light-dark, circles will be day, squares will be night, they'll be illustrated for the illumination conditions. So whether it's happening in light-dark, or light-light, or dark-dark, right, constant darkness or constant light, there's always the circadian regulation of behavior. And if that is the case, we thought, well, if there's a circadian change in the number of bouts the fish are making, and the bouts are stabilizing the fish, then at night they should really be unstable. Their posture should be all over the place. It should change quite a bit, but it doesn't. So fish can maintain, they don't go nose down at night because they stop making bouts. But I just told you the bouts are how they stop, right? What's going on? How are they solving this problem? How is it that fish can maintain posture given that they make fewer bouts at night? And the answer lies with the writing game. So remember, the writing game is the feature of the bout, at the end of the bout, after the fish has done most of its translating, where it produces a rotation that takes it back towards the horizon. I told you that the writing game was very low during the day, which is true. You can see that here. But at night, the writing game goes up considerably. So if the fish for each bout are better able to return to their stable posture, then they can maintain posture at night, despite the fact that the gravity doesn't vary with circadian time. Gravity is always there. But they're able to maintain a stable posture. And that turns out to be true whether we've kept them in constant light or in constant darkness. It's worth emphasizing just for a second how bonkers this result actually is. As best we could tell, all of the reflexive behaviors that we engage in that involve the sensory periphery, vision, smelling, audition, all are tamped down during circadian night. Certainly when we're asleep, when there's a major state change, but even as a function of circadian time. And here we have a reflex that is producing a much greater change in behavior during circadian night than it is during circadian day. And it's doing so to enable the fish to maintain its posture, or rather, as a consequence of this, the fish is able to maintain its posture at night despite making many fewer bouts. So to summarize this part of the talk, what David found was that fish make bouts when unstable. Each bout partially returns the fish to its preferred posture. Sensitivity to posture isn't different at night, and amazingly, fish are better able to return to their preferred posture at night. Whew. Okay, so there is one more little bit, so let's take the questions though, because there's
when you do the experiments, do they get their body through your food in the day or not?
Yeah, so one of the things that we tried to do a whole bunch is play with their density by just feeding them as much as we possibly could. And we never got anywhere. The amount of food that they seem to have in their bellies doesn't change. I would bet, to your specific question, that they feed more during the day than during the night, but I suspect that's a function of light being present and absent in one versus the other. Yeah. Michael, I think?
How much is being missed by only focusing on the bounce? Right? There's a lot of stuff that you draw thresholds. And is it totally clear that there's no subtle stabilizing movement in the animal? Because if they're making fewer bouts at night,
That's right. So models that when we use the same models that we've developed before and we put in a term for the reflex gain, we can account for the majority of the behavior. So that's on the how much of the behavioral variability does this account for? That's how we've addressed that. When we look very closely with the high-res videos at what's going on during the pauses, we see neither systematic changes nor any observable muscular contractions that would lead us to believe they're doing something else. Jimmy asked before, what about the fins? What about the pectoral fins? So let's talk about that. Because, of course, we have arms, zebrafish have other ways of stabilizing themselves. Maybe they're using the pectoral fins. The adults certainly do, right? Adult fish, that's been well established, can use their pectoral fins, the ones that are up front and kind of stick out to the side, to do all kinds of amazing things in terms of maneuvering and changing the orientation of their bodies. The gospel so far, which was from looking at mutants that never developed pectoral fins and pectoral fin removal, but only in a monolayer, has been that the pectoral fins don't do all that much for the larvae. But we found that they do. So this is a story about how zebrafish come to climb. And the greater context for this study, why would David take this on? Well, what David was wondering about is something called the motor equivalence problem, which is that the animal, and any animal, can achieve a goal with a whole bunch of redundant movements, right? There is no one right path to achieve something. And his hypothesis was that locomotion develops in the way that it does because preferences are learned. So though there are, you know, I could be crawling and I could navigate through this environment, but I don't. And I think I have a picture, yeah. So even infants, right, this little tiny baby is on a treadmill. And what Esther Palin found is that if you take babies and you put them on a treadmill well before they're able to walk, their legs will actually go into a walking gait that is comparable to what they will do later. So the circuits, if I may, the nervous system's ability to produce a particular behavior may be there well before an animal actually chooses to adopt that behavior. So the idea is that zebrafish can climb using either their tails or their pectoral fins at all ages, but that they come to do so preferentially. They come to use their pectoral fins preferentially as they get older, even though they can earlier on. So they can climb using their bodies or their fins, and that swimming, as we know it, matures via acquired preference for the fins. Okay, so how is it that fish could climb? Well, the fish with some things, right? Not pictured as lift, but you can see the posture, that's what we've been talking about a lot, and thrust to produce a particular trajectory, right? This is how a plane would climb. It would rotate, and it would continue thrusting in this direction. Here's a fish that will largely go where its nose is pointed. It will rotate when it wants to go up. This is the graph I showed you before. By and large, this is at 7 days. At young ages, fish go where their nose are pointed, almost exclusively. A little bit of variability up here. The other way that you could go up is like a helicopter, right? You can generate lift directly. So this is lift now. If you were to thrust here, and you had some way of generating lift, your trajectory would be different from the direction of thrust. That difference is the key measure for the next few figures. We'll call that the attack angle, the angle between where the fish went and where it was pointed. If it had a way to generate lift, then you would see values here that would indicate that the fish went up, because the actual trajectory would be the sum of the lift and the thrust. So how would a fish do that? Here's a fish that's going to go up without actually translating. So it's not thrusting. Oops, sorry. Let's see if we can get that to play. You can see it go up. Here, Jimmy, are the pectoral fins. This one's a little bit tricky. You're looking at the fish from behind. So the tail is coming out here and going out of focus. Here are the pectoral fins. The fish is going to go up. The fish is going to go up. It's moving both tail, but you can see the fins are flapping.
Did you try to remove the pectoral fins?
Hey, good question. So, at 21 days, if we plot that graph that you've seen a bunch before now, posture versus trajectory, here's the control data. You can see at 21 days, you no longer fall along the unity line. That is to say, you're not going exclusively where your nose is pointed. If you lose your pectoral fins, this all goes away. You fall right along the unity line, and in order to achieve a different elevation, the fish actually have to rotate their bodies. There's a lot of kinematics that I'm skipping to show you that, by and large, except for this, these guys are very similar.
It's only at 21 days.
Hey, good question. let me just parameterize the attack angle, right, just to show you that this is what goes away. right? You have a difference, right? And then, yes, so the attack angle is much, much lower. That is, fish go where their nose are pointed, like I had shown you, mostly earlier. And that changes. So something is changing as the fish are getting older. Their attack angles are changing. We think it's due to the pectoral fins, because if I take away the pectoral fins, it goes away.
So what comes first? Is it the motion of the tail or the movement?
We don't have the resolution to tell that. That's a great... Yeah, at a certain point, you know, you're seeing the videos, they look pretty good, but being able to resolve tail and fin in the same plane with sufficient spatial and temporal resolution has just eluded us so far.
I have a quick question.
Please.
So for posture, mm-hmm. Are these fins also kicking to maintain the posture pitch up of the animal? I'm not talking about lift, I'm just talking about posture.
That's right. So
which would be going back to my previous question, mm-hmm. right? Yeah.
And also, I think to Michael's,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
I think you guys are picking up on something. Again, I would be happy to show you the supplemental figures, right, that show that when you remove the fins, there are differences in posture,
right,
that globally across the mm-hmm. experiment. So again, we can't rule out that there isn't something so small and subtle that we're missing it, but without the fins, there isn't a huge difference. So so now the 7-day fish aren't using their fins most of the time, but can they? In the same way that I could crawl, or the baby in the Talon study could walk. So we asked, are they making bouts at all with big attack angles? This is 7-day-old controls versus the finless. And what you can see is that indeed there is a consequence to losing your fins at 7 days. You don't see nearly as many bouts. Right, the percentage of bouts with an attack angle changes pretty drastically. I think I have one more figure to... No, I don't have another figure to emphasize that. But the 7-day-old fish, as best we can tell, can use their pectoral fins. And when they do use their pectoral fins, they can achieve lift. They just don't. So we think, as development is proceeding, something is changing about... whether they're producing thrust with their tails and or the fins. So do they acquire a preference for fin use? So one way to ask this question is to plot the attack angle, that is the difference between where they're pointed and where they go, as a function of the body rotation. Why would we do that? Well, we would expect a mostly sigmoidal curve, right? The low attack angle of low body rotations, when the body is rotated like so, if the fish is really trying to elevate, you may get a larger attack angle. So if the fish were equally capable but preferred one movement versus the other, then for a given body rotation, what we would see is a shift in the slope of this curve as the fish got older. So the fish could have a body rotation closer to zero, but be using its fins, so it's producing more lift, so its attack angle increases, so the slope is changing. The other thing that might change is that the capability would change. So something, as the fish is getting older, just getting better at something. And so for the same body rotation, say out here at 10 degrees, it just produces ever-increasing attack angles because it's just getting better at doing what it's doing. When we look at the data for 1, 2, and 3 weeks for different attack angles, you can see the data does indeed fall on a sigmoidal curve. The raw data is black and it's messy because it's binned and we have to count a lot of things. But it's real. And then this is a model fit. We're just fitting a sigmoidal function to these. And the error...
What is the body rotation? I'm lost.
Oh, the body rotation is just how the body's oriented.
Before
the bout.
Before the bout.
Yes.
So it orients, and then it moves up.
It would reorient, then move up. That's right. So if it were...
So the loop, that should be always pretty close to the attack angle, right? Because if then it goes more or less straight, which you showed, right? It should more or less... I mean, it should be really close.
If the fish is producing lift beyond that which is produced in the body rotation, for a 7-day fish, your intuition is right. It should be really close.
Okay. But then later,
right. Yes. So if we look at the parameters of the sigmoid fit, for capability, that's the amplitude of that sigmoid, at which the sigmoid asymptotes, and it's not different. But the preference or the slope of that sigmoid changes pretty drastically. So let's see. Nope, I'm not going to have time to tell you about this model, but this is the closest that we've gotten to navigation, is to use these two. Put all of these terms into a generative model of fish swimming, and then give them a goal, and say, how long does it take you to reach this elevation, if it's up or if it's down, as a function of how you are weighting the fin control or the body control. So there's a lot more to talk about, and I'd love to continue to talk about it, and some of the questions, I apologize, I didn't get to answer, but broadly, zebrafish come to climb by acquiring a preference for using their pectoral fins. So I told you why zebrafish move when they do. That's the bit about timing their bouts in response to essentially gravity to deal with that. I've told you how zebrafish explore depth and shown you that by thinking about these phenomenology, we can explain something puzzling which should be happening at night but doesn't seem to be. And then I've told you our initial investigations into how zebrafish come to climb. And with that, I'll thank my lab and funding sources, and particularly David Ehrlich, who's a postdoc who has really been the powerhouse of ideas and data collection and analysis and modeling behind all of this. So thanks, David, and thanks, you guys. Please.
Horizon with respect to gravity. How do they sense gravity?
Oh, good. Yeah, so there's a whole lot of how do they do this that I didn't get to talk about. During the day, when they have light, they can use two, there are two ways, as best we can tell, that they can sense how they are relative to the horizon. The first is an inertial accelerometer that is in the inner ear called the utricle. We have one too. They are using their utricle, as best we can tell, exclusively to tell how the orientation, how the body is oriented relative to gravity. So they have an accelerometer, so that can work in the dark and in the light, and they rely mostly on that. If you have a mutant zebrafish that doesn't develop a utricle, those guys can swim around in the light and can orient where the dorsal part of their body stays up relative to the light, and the ventral part is down, so they can stabilize in pitch and roll a little bit by using visual cues. So visual and vestibular is the answer to how.
So the follow-up question on that would be very fun to see how they do with the circadian study you do, because at night, they don't have light, they must rely on...
Did I put those slides in? Yeah. Did I? No, I took them out.
Okay.
What changes? So the bout rate, so they swim about the same amount of time, right? Their interbout interval is about the same if they have no vestibular end organ or if they do. What changes, as you would expect, is the relationship between pitch and velocity and bout timing, and that goes completely away. So that's true if you eliminate the vestibular end organ so they can't sense, or if you get rid of these neurons, which are receiving information from the inner ear and relaying them to ocular eye movement and postural control centers. So those are also responsible for, as best we can figure, for instantiating the transformation between sensed body orientation and probability of movement.
So are they swimming when they sleep, or do they just go down and rest at the bottom?
I don't know that they sleep. they swim, they have many, many fewer bouts, but we are imaging the center of the chamber, and we get enough data during the night to make conclusions about that. So they seem to be swimming in different parts, right, in the chamber. Of course, the chamber is a very poor approximation to the actual water column that they have in the wild. And they may well be lower in the water column. Many, many, many of these species, Jimmy, you may know this even better than I do, will change their position in the water column as a function of circadian day. It's thought mostly because that so does the food that they eat, right? Which also varies because it needs to go up towards the light or come down. So because
they are in running water in nature, right? So they would need to.
These guys are found across a wide range of habitats, some basically in puddles or in rice paddies where the water is mostly still, and others in fast flowing streams. So, you know, and you would expect, again, building on the observations that Jimmy showed yesterday, that their behavior would also change in the presence of flow in all kinds of interesting ways. Absolutely. Should we go to coffee?
I think we should.
Yeah, let's.
Thank you. Please, let's